I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. The United States spends more money on national defense than any other country by far. It accounts for something like 15% of all federal spending and half of all discretionary spending. The Senate Armed Services Committee and the House Appropriations Committee are working on their defense spending plans, largely behind closed doors, which will take them well into the summer. The Trump administration has asked for $750 billion to fund the military. Meanwhile, last year, the Department of Defense failed its first ever audit. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican from Iowa and chair of the Finance Committee, spoke last week on the Senate floor about what he calls price gouging at the Pentagon.
Back in 1985, Americans will recall the Defense Department was shelling out vast amounts of taxpayer dollars for spare parts. Remember back then the $450 hammers and the $640 toilet seats. That sounds like a real bargain compared to the more recent wasteful spending at the Pentagon, such as the $1,280 coffee mug and the $14,000 toilet seat lid. Obviously, the cost of waste is getting a whole lot more expensive for our taxpayers.
Today in Radio Times, where does all that military money go and who is minding the store? Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is David Lindorf. He's a reporter, longtime contributor to The Nation magazine. He's also founding editor of the news site ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. He's also the 2019 recipient of the Park Center's I.F. Stone Award for Outstanding Independent Journalism, also known as the Izzy, for his story in The Nation titled The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed. David Lindorf, it's been a while. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Time.
Thanks for having me on, Marty.
You're welcome. And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Joe Gould, and he covers Congress for Defense News. And Joe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
So what kind of money are we talking about here? And I'm thinking about what Chuck Grassley just said about $1,200 coffee mugs. You're down there in Washington, D.C. The Trump administration has asked for $750 billion to fund the military. But is that the true amount of money we are spending on defense?
I think that $750 is almost kind of a fraction of what we spend on defense if you look at how much we're also spending to take care of veterans, people who serve. There's quite a bit more money, and there's a lot of pressure we've seen in the past week. Chuck Grassley's speech, Elizabeth Warren, in the last week is highlighted defensive accounting problems, the waste, fraud, and abuse. It's definitely in the spotlight this week.
So could we be talking trillions when we add it all up?
Over time, sure. Sure.
David, let me get you in on the conversation. You have looked at how the Defense Department does its budgeting.
Yeah. Well, let me first address the issue of how much we're spending, because it's more than $1 trillion in a year, not over time. Bill Hartung, who is a real expert on this, has written about it for years and who's at POGO, the Project for Government Oversight, did an article in The Nation just recently in which he tallied up what it is right now. And his total, when you add in, you know, the Veterans Administration, the contingency funding for foreign wars, which they started in the Bush administration to separate out from the Pentagon budget, the amount that's actually the debt payments on wars that the U.S. has already fought, that it fights on debt that has to be paid every year, all of those things, the intelligence budget, which is all related to war, the Homeland Security, which is in other countries, part of the military budget, and should be counted as that. He comes up with $1.25 trillion
a year.
This year in you know, what's been spent for 2019. And it'll be more coming up. So it's a huge amount of money. It's 57% of discretionary spending. It's 34% of all military spending in the world. And, you know, it's just what never gets discussed is how big it is and why we're spending that much money.
Well, let me go back to you, Joe, and actually go back to Senator Chuck Grassley. And he seems to be maybe with Elizabeth Warren and some others, but he has been in many ways this lone voice talking about fraud, waste, and abuse at the Pentagon.
Yeah, I think we saw some pretty unusual stuff in the last week. So one of the companies that Chuck Grassley was talking about is a company called TransDigm out of Cleveland, Ohio, and that got a lot of attention. The House Government and Oversight Committee held a hearing. The CEO of TransDigm was there. I mean, this is a company that buys proprietary aircraft parts. They might cost them, you know, $30 to make a part, and then they'll mark it up at about $5,000 for the Pentagon. From $30,000 to $5,000, and maybe they could argue that there are sunk costs in buying these things, but sitting across from the CEO, also Pentagon officials testifying, who were pretty shocked and horrified by this as well. But you had freshman House Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez grilling him, talking about how much how much we're spending here, and it could be used for how many doses of insulin could we buy for that amount of money. And then on the flip side, the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus, conservative House Freedom Caucus, Mark Meadows, a staunch Republican who probably doesn't agree with AOC on much, also grilling the CEO and giving it to him pretty hard. So Elizabeth Warren, Chuck Grassley, Mark Meadows, AOC. It's there's a kind of a bipartisan pressure, but I would say that there's a lot of probably, as David knows, and as Bill Hartung, who he cited, knows, there's a lot of vested interests in seeing a large Pentagon budget.
Well, let me go back to you, David. And it is sort of shocking that members of Congress who are supposed to provide oversight into things like military spending, that they are shocked about the amount of money that's being spent on coffee cups or, you know, the kind of markup that Joe just described.
Well, you know, when they talk about this kind of spending on, you know, the coffee mug and things, it is a shocker, but it's almost a diversion from the big issue. I mean, let's take Lockheed and its F-35, which is the biggest weapon system spending ever for any weapon in the history of mankind in real dollars or any dollars. And that plane was getting so expensive that everybody was starting to freak out. The Air Force actually said last year that they couldn't figure out what Lockheed was doing with the contractor support funds, which is an enormous part of the budget over time, and was saying they don't know how they're spending that money. They were so upset at the cost of the plane over time for maintenance and upgrades and everything that they were thinking of cutting their order by a third.
Wow.
And so what does Lockheed do? They just announced that they're giving a price reduction of 10%. Where the hell did that come from? You know,
they're making up these numbers in a sense?
No, they're not making up they're making profits that they don't deserve or don't need. If they can cut the price of that plane when the complaints start rising by 10%, that's a random figure they came up with to quiet people down. It's a joke. And this is a plane that was put into production when it's not ready to fly in combat. And then the idea is they'll just keep upgrading it after it's out. It's a crazy way to make whether you like the weapon or not, it's a crazy way to make a weapon on the fly after it, literally on the fly.
Joe, let me go back to you. And the Department of Defense failed this audit last year. How significant is that?
Well, I think if it depends on who you ask.
Of course.
Think if you talk to the Pentagon, they would say this is what we expect. I mean, I think they deserve some credit for getting to this place after years of not being audited at all. They're finally enacting this audit bit by bit, and it's not. I don't think it's surprising to anybody that if you start to overturn rocks, you're going to find problems, and failing an audit is the process for kind of getting to a solution and correcting. But yeah, you're right. I think that there are folks who are pretty upset that the Pentagon, which is a, I mean, they're asking for a $750 billion national security budget this year, and the Pentagon, which is a large share of that,
sure,
has never been audited. It's that and the waste, fraud, and abuse that we're talking about this week, I think, is creating a lot of pressure.
Well, let me go back to you, David. In many ways, this is what your award-winning article is about, is about, as you describe it, this accounting fraud and how money is moved around within the Pentagon budget.
That's that, too. Let me take a different approach to this.
Sure.
Shanahan announced that they had failed the audit.
Acting Defense Secretary.
The acting secretary, now nominated for actual, formally, you know, Secretary of Defense. When he announced that the audit had been failed, he said, "We failed the audit and we expected to fail it." Excuse me. And we should get credit, though, because, you know, we did the audit. We tried to do it. The reality is that Congress passed a bill in 1990 called the CFO Act, which required every federal agency and department to have to develop a auditable budget and to submit to audits every year. 1990, that is 29 years ago.
Yes.
It's a long time ago. The Pentagon has never, they've stonewalled is the word, doing that. They have not tried to do an audit until this past year. They would audit, they sample audited a few times, one branch or something, and always failed. And they did not, they claim, oh, we have legacy systems. Well, the legacy systems that they're talking about in 1990, I was using a Kpro computer. You know, in all that time, with the vast amount of money that the Pentagon gets every year, they could have gotten, I don't know, IBM, you know, supercomputers and put in there. There was so much they could have done that they didn't want to do. And what my sources told me, and these are like sources who are named sources, like Mark Armstrong, who was the supervising audit director for Pentagon audits at the Office of Inspector General, said they don't want it. They haven't wanted to be audited. They still don't want to be audited. And what they submit to Congress every year as their financial statements for spending of the prior year in each budget request, accompanying each budget request, is garbage. And he said they should say to Congress, these documents we're submitting to you are garbage. If they did that, one would expect there would be hearings, there would be heads rolling, but we never get any of that.
And that's a direct quote, garbage.
Garbage.
And we are talking about the military budget with our guests, David Lindorf and Joe Gould. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and I'm Marty Moscoane talking with David Lindorf. He's a reporter, longtime contributor to The Nation magazine, has been writing about the Pentagon budget. Also with us and joining us from the studios in Washington, D.C. is Joe Gould, and he covers Congress for Defense News. And yes, we are talking about military spending. Let me play a clip from Senator Elizabeth Warren. This was the Senate Armed Services Committee. She sits on the committee, and this is November 28th, 2018.
There's no doubt that the Budget Control Act contributed to a decline in defense spending, but I just want to put that in some perspective. The defense budget bottomed out at an eye-popping $586 billion in FY15. And despite that decline, we still spend more than the next seven nations combined, and that includes several of our allies. So what have we gotten with all that money?
A good question. But, Joe, is there an appetite in Congress to actually reduce Pentagon spending, knowing that the Pentagon has factories and bases in states all over the country?
Yeah, I think what you're touching on there is key, is that, you know, we were talking about the F-35, which is a very expensive fifth-generation fighter plane. Well, there are parts for that that are made all over the country. There are a lot of different constituencies involved, and I think it's actually very tough. That said, I think some of the issues that we talked about are being picked up by House Democrats. The one thing that we didn't talk about is the president's use of defense funding for a border wall, declaring a national emergency and then repurposing funding for a border wall. And I think, you know, there are especially Democratic lawmakers who say that the Pentagon is missing some credibility when it can easily move money for a border wall that's highly controversial and then claim that it needs every dime that it's asked Congress for. So taken together, the sort of the waste, fraud, and abuse question, the auditability question, I think that the border wall question is highly highly charged. There's going to be some pushback this year, definitely, on increasing defense spending.
Well, let me just put some numbers to that. We're talking about $402 million from the Air Force to be spent on the border wall. Do we have those numbers right, Joe?
Sounds right to me.
I think I might be quoting you from one of your stories.
Okay.
But
so then it's definitely right.
of course.
One of the arguments that you hear from House and Senate Democrats is that you have natural disasters that have struck Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida, Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska had suffered from flooding, Camp Lejeune. All of these bases that have needs, military construction needs, how can the Pentagon justify moving that money for a border wall when there are bases that have legitimate needs for military construction funding?
David, let me go back to you and even going back to your report where you said you take apart how the Pentagon makes these budgetary decisions and literally how they move money around. There's a name for that, I guess, plugs?
Yeah, well, what happens is that there's this enormous facility in Indiana, the Defense Finance Accounting Office. I forget the letters. DF.
It's okay.
A something.
DFAS.
DFAS.
Which, it's really an army of accountants. And what they do is they crunch all these numbers. They never get all the numbers right. And at the end, they put a number in that they, and this is on the spending end, the income side, assets and liabilities. They put in these numbers, which they call in Pentagon jargon, this is not an accounting term, they call them plugs. And it's really a bad joke that they use at the Pentagon. You know, to just plug in a number because they don't have a valid number for these things. And sometimes these plugs can be $1 trillion in a budget that isn't $1 trillion. You know, and it's just one category of spending or of income, and some of them balance out. It's not real money. Their numbers, but what they do is they make it indecipherable what's going on, so that, you know, when the audit was being done, I was told by people at the time, including this guy Asif Khan, who heads the National Defense Asset Management Unit of the GAO, the General Accounting Office, or the Government Accountability Office, said they're not going to be able to audit the Pentagon. It's going to be a failure because they have so many fake numbers that aren't reliable that in every year they can't even go back to the last year to get honest numbers to look at, which you need when you do accounting. So he said as a result, they're not going to be able to audit it next year, the year after, 5 years from now will be difficult, even if with the best of intention. Now, this is the point here, is this guy is responsible for overseeing the Pentagon's budget, and he says you can't do it. And he says that the Pentagon is at the top of his list of federal agencies at risk of fraud and abuse, right? Now, I would think taxpayers would be going ballistic and members of Congress would be going ballistic if this were the EPA, Health and Human Services, the popular agencies for fraud, right, that everybody says, Education Department, Labor Department. If it were any of those, there'd be hearings, heads would be rolling, and everything. But with the Defense Department, it's like nobody even talks about it.
Well,
it's insane.
Joe, do you agree with that? I mean, we're talking about it, but, you know, I have to say I had to dig deep to get some of the research to do, put the show together.
I mean, when it comes down to Pentagon accounting practices, I would definitely defer to David. But you know, I think that what we're missing is kind of a larger strategic conversation. You know, this is to just to kind of take these questions in context a little bit. You know, when we're talking about Democrats putting pressure on the defense budget, we're talking about maybe freeing up more money for other parts of the budget, the non-defense side of the budget. And if the, you know, if the Trump administration, if Republicans want more money for defense as part of a grand strategy that's focused on Russia and China, you know, how about having a national conversation? Are we seeing, you know, what kind of national conversation are we saying? What kind of messaging are we seeing from, say, the commander in chief about what the, you know, what the Pentagon needs, why it needs it? It's just not a detailed conversation that's you know, that's engaging the American public. Maybe we'll see that in the 2020 races, but I'm waiting for it.
Well, it sounds like you're saying, what's the policy, and then how do we pay for it?
Precisely.
Well, we haven't had I would agree. We need a strategic discussion, because it's insane to think that a country can continue to spend this percentage of its budget on military, and nobody's asking why we're doing it. Mm-hmm. Nobody's saying, you know, why does America need $1 trillion annual defense? It's not defense either. It's a military budget. The U.S. has a first strike policy. The F-35 is a first strike weapon to drop nuclear bombs inside of countries with advanced radar. Nobody talks about this stuff. And so really what we need to do is say Russia has a budget that's a third of the U.S. Veterans Administration budget. China has a military budget in total that's smaller than the U.S. Veterans Administration budget. We have a budget that's 34% of the entire world's military budget. We don't win wars with it. We're not even fighting any wars with it right now. I mean, you can't really count Afghanistan as a war with 15,000 troops. We had 500,000 troops in Vietnam. It's crazy to have a military budget this size. It's crazy to be talking offense all the time, which we are doing. And we're not making the world safer. So we need a line item discussion defending every line item in the Pentagon budget. And why do we have it?
And that's David Lindorf. And he is a longtime contributor to The Nation magazine. Also with us is Joe Gould. He covers Congress for Defense News. And yes, we are talking about the military budget. Let me read a couple of comments and we'll get Katie from Philadelphia to join us. Carrie says, this shouldn't be a surprise because as a capitalistic society, we expect to make a profit. This is a business and I sympathize with the manufacturers trying to make money. James says, aren't we just stating the obvious here? No one believes there are $1,200 coffee cups. So clearly this money is being funneled somewhere else. An email from Daniel says, every congressperson is glad to have defense contracts come to their state because they bring in federal money as local salaries. So are they feigning outrage at the costs as their districts benefit from those dollars pouring into their districts? I think we have touched on those three important issues. Let me get Katie from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Katie. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a Department of Defense retiree. I worked for them for over a quarter of a century in five different agencies. And I can tell you at the peon level that at the end of every fiscal year, the department heads were frantic that their budgets not be cut. And we were told if there was any money left over in the budget, we needed to spend it so that we could go back to Congress and say we spent every dime and next year we need more. In one of my offices, every single person in the building received a desktop electric pencil sharpener, as that was one of the ways that the money was used up. So that's at the you know, first level.
Well,
that's what it looked like.
I appreciate the call.
Nobody ever talked about budgeting. Nobody ever talked about about trying to trim or look for ways to trim. It was only spend every dollar we've been given so that we can go back and ask for more.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Joe, can I put that to you since you cover Congress? I mean, we're looking at defense, but is that unusual? Is the Defense Department or the military budget or the Pentagon, whatever you want to call it, is that really an outlier when it comes to budgeting?
No, not at all. You know, scrambling to spend to spend what's left in the budget at the end of the sort of at the end of the fiscal year, I think is something that we hear about increasingly on Capitol Hill. I think one of the things that we haven't addressed is Congress as a part of these budgeting problems. Every year for as long as I've been covering defense appropriations, the bills have come late every year, and so if you pass a defense budget for the entire fiscal year and it's several months after the fiscal year has ended, as Congress has typically done, mm-hmm. The hyper-partisan environment that we're in right now makes these kinds of deals increasingly difficult. They drag on. The border wall issue, which is highly controversial, slows things down. And so what you have at the Pentagon is folks who are receiving a full amount of a full fiscal year of money within a set period of time. Now, and David, knowing what he knows about defense accounting, probably knows this, but certain pots of money you can have more flexibility to spend over multiple years, but some money is just for a single year. So what the caller Katie was talking about is definitely something I've heard before.
Well, let me go back to you, David. Is this then a need for, more transparency, but even many of these negotiations are happening behind closed doors. Should those doors be open?
They're wrongly closed because these are not secrets that need to be kept from the adversaries, as we call them now. I think that the problem is that the Pentagon is sacrosanct. You know, especially since 9/11, if we call everyone in a uniform a hero, and we look at the Pentagon as a bunch of people in uniforms, we're considering them to be somehow better than other people in government. And it's not true. They're the same kind of self-aggrandizing, empire builders as people are in any other department of government. And we don't view them the same way, but we should. They should be held to the same accountability. They should be fired when they're corrupt. They should be, have their stars yanked off them. All of these things should happen, and they don't. So until we are willing to look at the Defense Department as just another department with all the same bureaucratic drives, we're not going to fix it. But also, the other thing is, let's look at we don't want to go through this show without mentioning Patrick Shanahan, who is the poster child for what's wrong with our military. Because we have a guy who's never been in the military, never even been in government, who was a middle office management guy in charge of the civil branch of Boeing, which I think was overseeing the development of the 737 that's giving us all these problems. And he's being put up for Secretary of Defense, which should be called the Secretary of War, and who is, basically has been accused of having favored his own employer in contracts. The OIG cleared him, but this is the same OIG that has not punished anybody for the problems it's found in budgeting. So I don't know. There ought to be an outside review of this guy before he's made Secretary of Defense.
Well, Joe, is there a timetable for when there will be hearings about Shanahan for Secretary of Defense?
Well, as you alluded to at the top of the program, the Senate Armed Services Committee is putting together its policy bill this week. That's a process that that can go on for a while. But I think after the recess, to be honest, the clock starts when he's officially nominated. And although the president has indicated that he'll nominate Shanahan, we haven't received that yet. And the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Jim Inhofe, Republican from Oklahoma, has said he would like the White House to hurry up and nominate Shanahan. Huh.
Do you think, if that happens, that he will sail through, or do you think he's going to have some explaining to do?
No, I think in part for some of the issues that, that David raised, I think he is he's potentially going to have a rocky time of it. I think, as you know, having watched some of these hearings, you know how they go. They're typically fairly partisan. He'll likely have, you know, safe harbor in these hearings from Republicans, although some of them may have some tough questions for him. But Democrats are likely to kind of hit him on his Boeing connections, his you know, his lack of experience, potentially his I think, again, this border wall issue is likely to come up. He's been cooperative with the administration or not sufficiently uncooperative. So I think all of those issues are going to make it difficult for him. But I mean, I can count the Republicans control the Senate, and it's, you know, it's likely that he'll be confirmed.
David, final question to you. And keying off your article, the Pentagon's massive accounting fraud exposed, is that how we get to $750 billion as a proposed budget for the Pentagon?
It is, because it's a built-in escalator. If you don't know what the Pentagon's actually spent in the prior year, and we don't. Nobody knows how much of the money they get each year was actually spent or on what it was spent, because they're illegally shifting money from like 1 year money to 5 year money and that kind of thing. So it makes it totally impossible to know what they're spending, and even if they spent it all. And then they come in and ask for more, and Congress obligingly these days gives them usually more than they asked for. So it's a built-in escalator with no justification. And that's why we're getting where we are, and why it's. But this has been a decades-long process, and guilty are both the Democrats and the Republicans.
And 10 seconds. Do you have any confidence that there will be reforms?
Absolutely none.
Absolutely none.
And not until the voters demand it.
Well, we're going to leave it there. David Lindorf, thank you for coming in. Thanks for joining us today in Radio
Thanks
Times.
And me.
He's a reporter, longtime contributor to The Nation magazine, and his article, The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed, won the Izzy Award.
And it's available online.
And Joe Gould, thank you very much for joining us as
thank
well.
You.
And he covers Congress for Defense News. And we have Robin Wright. She'll be joining us after this short break. We'll be talking about the U.S. and Iran in a standoff. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Senior administration officials are briefing members of Congress today in closed-door sessions about Iran as a military and rhetorical confrontation heats up. President Trump tweeted on Sunday, "If Iran wants to fight, that will be the official end of Iran. Never threaten the United States again." When asked last week about whether the U.S. would go to war with Iran, Trump's answer was, "Hope not." The administration, after pulling out of the Iranian nuclear deal, has increased pressure on the country, moving military warships to the region and threatening to punish anyone or any country that buys oil from Iran. National Security Advisor John Bolton has been a hawk on Iran, even calling for attacking the country a few years ago in an op-ed in the New York Times. Iran's foreign minister said today in an interview on CNN that his country won't negotiate with President Trump unless the U.S. shows Tehran, quote, respect, and warned America is playing a very, very dangerous game. We asked Robin Wright to join us. She's a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center, a contributing writer to The New Yorker. I should add she has reported from more than 140 countries on six continents and has covered a dozen wars and several revolutions. Robin Wright, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
Well, the most obvious question, are we on the cusp of a war with Iran?
There's clearly been an escalation in the tensions between Tehran and Washington over the last 2 months, particularly over the last couple of weeks with the deployment of the USS Abraham Lincoln, as well as B-52 bombers. I do not believe that we are on the cusp of an imminent war. I do worry that there are a number of things, as these tensions continue to ratchet up, that there's a potential for a kind of mistake or provocation that leads to something that neither country really wants. The question, though, is what is the off-ramp, and is there any give by either side in the list of demands? The United States has outlined 12 points that amount not just to policy change, but almost amount to an overhaul in the political system and even among the policymakers in Iran. Meanwhile, the Iranians have given a time deadline now to the other major powers, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China, who signed the nuclear deal in 2015, to show that the deal should be sustained, that Iran should continue to honor its commitment not to develop the world's deadliest weapon. And so we're in this moment of that there's a little bit of pushback now against the idea of war. President Trump has said he doesn't want it. The Iranians have made clear repeatedly that they want to avoid a war. But how do you get beyond this point where there are demands by both sides that neither may meet? And that's what worries me long term as this plays out.
Well, let me follow up with a couple of questions. When you say you worry, and I think others as well worry, that there might be some kind of mistake or something happens that was unintended, what would be one of those mistakes, just so we know what we're talking about here?
Well, you know, there are a lot of different things, and we've begun to see some that lead to questions about what does Iran really not want a showdown. The attacks on these four tankers clearly was something that went beyond. It was a violation of international protocol. This was a violation of the terms of peace among nations. And it's interesting that we haven't seen pushback, and it may be because the investigations are going on. I think everyone looks at it and believes that Iran had a hand, whether it was through their proxies or directly, in there were two Saudi tankers, one from Norway, and I think the third one's from the United Arab Emirates. And there were small holes in the hull of these tankers, but this was a provocative act. Is there some the loss of American life, some kind of attack, whether it's an American dies by driving over an explosive device? We have 5,000 troops still in Iraq, 2,000 in Syria. Both places, Iran has militias that are still very loyal to Tehran. Is there some kind of something that looks that it was targeted directly at the Americans? And I think there is some concern. The Iranians also know that the U.S. could destroy Iran very quickly, whether it's attacking its nuclear installations that have so far continued to comply with the deal, but could, if at some point the Iranians walk away from the nuclear deal, could become potential targets? Or is it going after, for example, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards in the Navy, who are sharing the same Gulf waters as the USS Lincoln and other American warships? So there are lots of different venues that this could play out in a lot of different ways.
Well, let me ask you about John Bolton. He is National Security Advisor. As I mentioned, he had a piece in the New York Times. This was back in 2015 when the Obama administration was negotiating the nuclear arms deal. And it's a complicated piece, but the headline was very arresting: to stop Iran's bomb Iran. How much do you think his view of Iran is the same as it was in 2015, and does he want to bomb Iran?
John Bolton's views on Iran have not changed, but he is not speaking the same language today, in part because he is working for an administration. There's no question that he ultimately wants regime change. He, for 8 years, was the primary spokesman and keynote speaker for an Iranian opposition group. He talked at their conferences about regime change and that having their next meeting in Tehran with a different government in power. You pointed out that he's willing to take military action to achieve that, as he said in the past. This is where I think within the administration you have three different voices: the president, the national security advisor, and the secretary of state, Mike Pompeo. They all agree what they don't want to see Iran do. They don't want it to have a nuclear program. They want it to stop meddling in the region, stop its missile tests, stop its human rights violations, stop picking up foreign hostages. But they begin to disagree about how far they're willing to go. And this is where John Bolton is clearly the most hawkish, the most militant in proposing and, you know, asking the Pentagon to dust off war plans and discuss what it would take, including deploying 120,000 Americans in the Persian Gulf. Mike Pompeo, when he was a congressman, also talked about regime change, favored it. He has talked, as Secretary of State, more about Iran changing its behavior. But he was the one who outlined these 12 points, and these are 12 points that are so sweeping that they come very close to implying regime change. But again, he, you know, is he willing to use military force? And I suspect he may be less enthusiastic about it. Then you have the president, who is the most different of all of them. He is
he's all over the place, isn't he?
Well, he's all over the place, but he has repeatedly talked to, made overtures to Iran.
Right.
Let's talk. He said he'd engage with the supreme leader in a way like he did with Kim Jong-un, the strongman leader of North Korea. He doesn't think there's any dictator he can't talk to, and he's made that overture. The Iranian foreign minister, whom I met with last month in New York when he was at the United Nations, told me that they'd made almost a dozen overtures just under the Trump administration to the Iranians. For example, when President Rouhani of Iran was at in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, that there have been these overtures to talk. So there has been outreach, and I think the president does believe that he could talk. But again, he doesn't. He wants to do some kind of big deal that deals with all of the issues on the table rather than the Obama administration's approach, which was to take the most dangerous issue, the nuclear program, off the table so that that would not be something the Iranians could hold over their head if they talked about all these other issues. And so they're two very different approaches. But the president is not opposed to diplomacy, even as he threatens, as he did on Sunday, that if Iran, you know, engaged in some kind of provocation, that would be the end of Iran, which, you know, is true hyperbole. This is a country, this is not Iraq, this is not Afghanistan. A war with Iran would be far harder than both of the wars against Iraq and Afghanistan combined.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Robin Wright. She's a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center, also a contributing writer to The New Yorker. And we are talking about the conflict, the standoff, whatever you want to call it, even the confrontation between the United States and Iran. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me ask you, Robin, though, about Iran and oil. The United States essentially wants to cut off all exports from Iran to the rest of the world. Is that an act of war to prevent a country from selling a domestic product?
Is that a what?
An act of war on the United States part?
Oh, is it an act of war? Well, sanctions in many countries are an alternative to conflict.
Right.
And that's what the United States has tried repeatedly to force governments to change their policies, whether it's in North Korea, Russia, in South Africa during the days of apartheid. Sanctions is a very frustrating policy because it tends to be very slow. Now, one of the advantages the United States has is that oil transactions are carried out in dollars in most parts of the world. And any dollar transactions, even if it doesn't involve the United States or an American-affiliated company, because it's a dollar transaction, has to go through an American bank. And so the U.S. has leverage because it basically says there will be no sale of oil from Iran can go through an American bank. And any company that tries to buy or succeeds in buying Iranian oil will in turn also face sanctions by the United States. They can do no business. So there are a number of different aspects of sanctions that have been very effective. At the height of Iran oil sales, after the nuclear deal went into effect in 2016, agreed to in 2015, went into effect January 2016, Iran's oil sales reached 3.2 million barrels per day.
Mm-hmm.
Today, they're well below 1 million barrels a day and closer to 500,000 barrels a day. And that's really devastating economically. And President Rouhani acknowledged the impact and warned Iranians earlier this month that they could face sanctions as crippling, economic challenges as crippling as during the eight-year Iran-Iraq war. And I covered that war, and I remember going into stores in food stores in Tehran, and you'd find nothing on the shelves. You know, maybe a few bags of tea or rice, but there's just very little. Meat was rationed. Fuel was rationed. Parents weren't taking their kids to school because there wasn't public transportation, and they didn't have the fuel to drive them. And so the pinch is only beginning to be felt. It could be very significant. But will it have the effect that the United States intends or the Trump administration intends in the time period, whether it's 2 years of the left in the year and a half of the Trump administration or, you know, another 5.5 years if President Trump is reelected? And sanctions are very, very slow to take effect.
Sure.
And as the Iranian foreign minister said to me in December when I talked to him, if there's one thing the Iranians have learned over the last 40 years since the revolution, it's how to smuggle. And there will be, you know, attempts to discount oil. The Chinese have bought oil recently in defiance of U.S. sanctions because they're a signatory to the Iran nuclear deal and believe it should be enforced. So we're still in the buildup to that process, but sanctions have clearly had an impact.
And just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye, using sanctions as an example, is the goal then to essentially crush the Iranian people, or is it to crush them to the point where they will want regime change within their own country?
Well, it's a little bit of everything. It's either to get the regime to come to the table and engage in major changes, pulling back its proxy forces in the Middle East or moving them out of places like Syria and Yemen, stopping the flow of arms. It's also stopping missile tests. And, of course, Iran doesn't have much of an air force, so it relies on missiles for defense. And there are a number of steps it would have to take. So that's one option. You get them back to the table after they take a number of steps. The other is hoping for what amounts to a counter-revolution, that people rise up. Mm-hmm. The fact, though, is there are no signs of an opposition strong enough within the country to rally that. There's a lot of anger at the United States, which many Iranians hold accountable for the economic. They don't blame the government as much. Same time, there's very deep dissent in Iran. There's no question that the regime is increasingly unpopular, but you can't see it visibly to the point that you'd have another Green Movement uprising that would actually oust them. And of course, Iran has extraordinary police forces inside the country that could probably quash some kind of counter-revolution, unless it involved, 90% of the country or something. So we're not at a point yet that you see something changing, and that's the problem. How do you get out of this crisis?
Well, we will stay tuned, and I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
You're welcome. And she's Robin Wright, our guest, our final guest on Radio Times today. She's a distinguished fellow at the Wilson Center, a contributing writer to The New Yorker, has been writing a lot about Iran, in fact, reported from more than 140 countries on six continents, has covered a dozen wars and several revolutions. We were just talking about this standoff, this conflict between the United States and Iran. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.